This time on The Late Great News, Dr. Peter Dale Scott, author, researcher, professor, and poet, talks about allegations of collaboration between U.S. intelligence agencies and some unsavory outside interest.
The fact of the matter is that there's been more and more speculation in the press, and a lot of it has come just in the 2 or 3 months, that in fact the intelligence agencies of this country, of which the CIA is a prominent example, but not the only one, have been collaborating with organized crime inside this country and outside this country for what we might call common objectives.
Once again, The Late Great News digs into our audio archive to present a 1975 lecture by noted author and researcher Dr. Peter Dale Scott. In this lecture, he outlines some of his findings from extensive research into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Scott details numerous examples of questionable and sometimes illegal behavior by U.S. intelligence agencies. Keep in mind the current turmoil between these same agencies and the new U.S. administration. It appears likely these intelligence agencies will be reorganized to suit the politics of the new president. Past administrations have also put their own stamp onto the agencies with sometimes unfortunate results. Dr. Scott presents some unsettling examples that show what happens when personal political agendas influence the operations and goals of a nation's intelligence community.
I regard myself as a relative latecomer to the John F. Kennedy assassination study, a third-generation critic. We had the first generation who went after the Warren Report and more or less tore it to shreds. And I don't think there's anyone, for example, who's ever read Sylvia Meir's book, Accessory After the Fact, and could still believe in the Warren Report. We've had the second generation, people like Dr. Joling and Dr. Wecht, who are professionals and have brought professional competence to look at the evidence. And I hope that they will carry enough weight in Washington to force a reopening of the assassination of John F. Kennedy question. But although I have some faith that Congress will look at this question in the future, I think there is room for a third generation of critics who try to offer some kind of theory as to what it is they should look for. Now, some of this is technical, and I don't want to give this to you tonight, but I'd like tonight to go a bit beyond the kind of hard evidence that Allard Lowenstein and Dr. Joling have been giving to you to some matters which may be more inferential, softer, if you like, but which cumulatively, I think, present not only a general case for reopening, but the direction in which the investigation should go. Now, you heard my the title for this talk. It sounds rather sensational, if you like, an intelligence crime connection. The fact of the matter is that there's been more and more speculation in the press, and a lot of it has come just in the 2 or 3 months, that in fact the intelligence agencies of this country, of which the CIA is a prominent example but not the only one, have been collaborating with organized crime inside this country and outside this country for what we might call common objectives. And more specifically, what's relevant to what we're talking about tonight, that in the period 1960, 61, 62, as late as 1965 or 66 or 67, that one of these common objectives shared by intelligence agencies and organized crime was the assassination of Fidel Castro in Cuba. Now, this may sound like sensational talk, but the authority for it comes from high places. And one of the authorities that I want to cite to you tonight is Lyndon Johnson. Many of you have heard this, but I want to give you the exact words because they are important. There is going to be, I'm sure, a lot of talk about this in the future, and we want to make clear just what it is that is being talked about. What President Johnson said to an interviewer shortly before he died has to be listened to carefully, because it is, I think, in the version that it was printed in Atlantic Monthly, suggestively ambiguous, and I'm quoting now. Johnson said, Well, no, I'll go right back to the beginning. Johnson expressed his belief that the assassination in Dallas had been part of a conspiracy. This is the man who succeeded in office saying this, had been part of a conspiracy. Johnson said that when he had taken office, he found that, quote, we had been operating a damned murder incorporated in the Caribbean. A year or so before Kennedy's death, a CIA-backed assassination team had been picked up in Havana. Johnson speculated that Dallas had been a retaliation for this thwarted attempt. Now, I am sure we're going to, this is all going to be revived in 1975, and it already has been, and it is going to be suggested that clearly he's talking about Fidel Castro, and that somehow Fidel Castro had infiltrated the Dallas police and the Minutemen and all the other people who've been associated with what happened in Dallas. But if you listen to what is stated here, and if this is the correct wording, that the assassination was a retaliation for this thwarted attempt, that maybe what is really important is, and we know that this is true, that John F. Kennedy had been cracking down on these things in 1963. This is not a matter of speculation. This is a matter of the public record that in March and April of 1963, Kennedy said publicly, there are to be no more efforts mounted against Castro from the continental United States. That's not as categorical as I would have liked it to have been, but it is cracking down. And more specifically, in September 1963, the government made it known publicly that they were warning six individuals that they were to cease their efforts against Castro. This was published in the New York Times on September 16th, 1963, and I recall the exact date because one of those six names has since become rather famous. It was the name of a man known then as Frank Fiorini, and much more widely known today as Frank Sturgis, one of the Watergate burglars. Now, Jack Anderson speculated in 1971 that what was going on here was collaboration between intelligence and organized crime. It may be relevant that Frank Sturgis, or Fiorini, his real name, had been connected with casinos, stayed on shortly under Castro in connection with casinos. The important thing, to bring it back to Dallas and to what we know from the Warren Report and the Warren documents, and what I want to lay out to you tonight, is that if we look at the careers of Lee Harvey Oswald, on the one hand, we find that it is no ordinary career at all. The picture of a loner, a man who could never get recognition, melts away when we find the dozens of government files that were being kept on Lee Harvey Oswald because his case was almost certainly an intelligence matter, and that's what I want to talk about in connection with Oswald, and that Jack Ruby, on the other hand, was also not a loner, as the report went out of its way to suggest, but was a man with connections to organized crime, and much more interestingly than that, he was a kind of connection, a man who knew, at the very least, knew prominent people in the world of organized crime, but also had connections to the Dallas police and had connections to the political structure in Texas and perhaps also other parts of the United States. So both of these men were presented as loners, and in fact, both of them were connected on the one hand to intelligence, on the other hand to crime, and both of them, as we will see, to Cuba. Exactly what President Johnson was speculating about. Now, the more difficult one to prove is the case of Oswald. The government, I think, had much more at stake in suppressing the truth about Oswald than it did the truth about Ruby. So I will spend most of my time on the difficult case, the case of Oswald, to suggest why I think not that he was exactly a CIA agent, but that his name and his career was at the very least perceived by different elements in the U.S. government as being an intelligence case. You have to remember, he went to the Soviet Union. Some of you know, let me give you an example of what I would not take as evidence of his being a man with an intelligence background. The fact that he served at Atsugi in Japan as a Marine, and those of you who know anything about Japan and Atsugi will know that in 1958 and 59, when Oswald was there, that was one of the most important CIA bases in the Far East, and more specifically, was the base for the U-2s that took off from Japan in the Far East. Oswald in those days was a Marine working with radars, and it is possible that that's all he was, a man who probably had something to do with the U-2s coming in because he worked with aircraft approaching and so on. But more important is the way in which the government has lied about Oswald's record, starting at that time. Marguerite Oswald went to the Warren report and she said, my son was an intelligence agent because, and as proof of it, she said, after all, he served in Taiwan in the Quemoy, I think she called it the Formosa crisis, meaning the Quemoy crisis of 1958. And the Warren report went out of its way to prove that she was wrong and that in their version, Oswald had only been in Taiwan for one day on September 30th, 1958. And they made that the issue of whether or not he had been an intelligence agent. Well, on that point, I think Oswald was right, and there has been so much fudging of records as to suggest not only that the government was wrong, but also that they knew they were wrong and that they had something to hide. The government, the Warren Report worked, the Warren Commission worked from a set of documents that were given to them early on by the Defense Department, which talked about him being an Marine Air Group 11 and saying that it sailed into Taiwan and out again. However, a second set of records arrived 9 days before the Warren report was to go to press. It arrived on September 15th, 1964, much too late. The report was written at this time. There was nothing they could do about it. But if you looked at the pay records, which arrived at this time, they had Oswald in a different group at the same time, Marine Air Group 13. And in fact, if you check out what the Marine Air Groups, both of them, were doing in that year, they corroborate the pay records and not the original records. There had been a crisis. Oswald's group, Marine Air Group 11, had been rushed from Atsugi into Taiwan to deal with the Quemoy crisis. It went operational on September the 8th, exactly the day that Oswald's pay status changes. And then when Oswald went back to Atsugi in October 1958, the first records have him still in Marine Air Group 11, but he couldn't have been in Air Group 11. That was now in Taiwan. And a second air group had come to Atsugi, Marine Air Group 13, to replace Marine Air Group 11, and that's exactly where the pay records put him. Well, I don't want to go, it's all technical, but what's simple about it is that there are two sets of records, and it looks as if the government, if the government is going to the trouble to maintain two conflicting sets of records on Lee Harvey Oswald, it suggests that there's a lot more to him than the simple demented loner that we've been talked about. He defects to go to the Soviet Union, but in fact, what happens, he asks for a hardship release to support his mother. His mother in Fort Worth has been working in a candy store, and some boxes of candy fell on her nose and aggravated her sinus. So he applied for a hardship release, and he got it just like that. In fact, he got it so quickly that he got the release on September the 3rd, and the medical affidavits assigned by a Dr. Rex J. Howard and another Dr. Rex Z. Howard, those affidavits are filled out on September the 4th. So he had already got his hardship release. He'd been transferred for discharge, as they put it, the day before the affidavits were filled out. Now, some of you may have been in the Marines and know something about trying to get a hardship release. It's not usually that easy. He goes to the Soviet Union. As Sylvia Mars points out, he's stamped out of England in his passport on September the 10th, but that's too late. As I should have said October 10th, sorry, 1959. But that's too late for him to arrive in Helsinki, Finland, when it's known that he arrived. So the report just concludes, they said that as there were no commercial flights to get him there in time, he must have left on October the 9th. It's very possible, in fact, that he went on a non-commercial flight. But that suggests, of course, that again, that it's not just a loner who's going off to the Soviet Union, but somebody else. Finally, I'd like to talk raise the possibility, which has been in the press recently and will be in the press again next Sunday, that maybe the man who went to the Soviet Union is not the man who was shot in Dallas. The man who was shot in Dallas was measured twice at the autopsy and when he was arrested in New Orleans, and both times he was 5'9". The man who went to the Soviet Union, according to the first set of medical records, was measured when he left the Marines, and he was 5'11", so he had shrunk 2 inches. What's interesting about this is the consistency of the records. He is consistently 5'11" in 1959. When he comes back, he is consistently 5'9", and he does what, I may say parenthetically, many intelligence agents do. He rushes around establishing a documentary record that he's present somewhere. He fills out application forms for work, for driving licenses, all kinds of things, and he always puts himself down as being 5'9", with one exception. He applies for a new passport in 1963, and he has to submit his own old passport. Now, in his old passport, it says he's 5'11". So if he's really consistent and puts now that he's 5'9", it might create troubles about his getting a new passport. So on this one occasion in 1963, there are a dozen occasions in that year where he calls himself 5'9". On this one occasion, for the sake of consistency, he goes back to his old style of 1959 and calls himself 5'11". That suggests to me that the man applying for the passport knew of the sensitivity of this matter and knew that he was deceiving the government, even though it says very clearly on a passport application that to falsify any information on an application will be visited with very severe sanctions. Let me just add that many people were watching Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union. One of them was J. Edgar Hoover, who sent a warning to the State Department in 1960 that the man in the Soviet Union using Lee Harvey Oswald's birth certificate might be an imposter. And this possibility of an imposter raised by the FBI was subsequently repeated in 2 different State Department internal memoranda. The result of this was to create concern in Washington when Oswald contacted the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in 1961 and said, please give me back my passport. Those of you who know the Oswald story know that he had thrown the passport down on a table when he went into the embassy in 1959, said he wanted to renounce his citizenship. Never did. He left the passport. In 1961, he wanted it back, and a very clear instruction was sent from Washington to Moscow saying that Oswald was not to get his passport back until he had completed his travel plans to return to the United States. Now, that instruction was received in Moscow by a State Department officer called Richard E. Snyder, whose name is in that East German booklet, Who's Who in the CIA, and whose biography in the State Department Biographic Register reveals clearly his background is intelligence. He had gone to special training at Harvard. He's no dummy. And yet, receiving an instruction not to give Oswald his passport back until he had completed his travel arrangements, he went ahead. Oswald came in and said, oh, I've got married now. I won't be going back for a long time. Richard E. Snyder said, fine, here's your passport. Now, I used to work in a consular service myself for the Canadian government, and I know you don't normally do that. Especially if a man has an intelligence background and has gone to Harvard, it is particularly surprising that he should do so. And I think that people, when the Warren Commission got around to this, they realized that they had a problem on their hands. And they devote a total of 9 pages on the report to the specific subject of the return of Oswald's passport. And it's wonderful how they can snow you with factual data, because in those 9 pages they tell everything, and yet they never once point out this simple anomaly of somebody being told not to give a passport back, giving it the passport back. And of course, what Hoover was really frightened of was that the Soviet Union would get the passport. The instructions said, be careful not to send it by mail in the Soviet Union. They were frightened the Soviet government would get it, right? Well, Oswald got it on July the 11th, 1961, and 4 days later, he knows it's his wife's case that's going to take the long time, at both ends, both in the Soviet Union and in the United States. She doesn't apply until August the 20th, 1961, for a visa at all. Oswald's case, which will be relatively simple, and which he really ought to, when he gets a visa, it's only going to be valid, an exit visa will only be valid for 45 days anyway, so he should delay. But instead, he does exactly what Hoover had most feared. He goes straight to the Soviet government and says, look, someday I'm going to want to go back to the United States. My wife will be applying soon. Meanwhile, here's my passport. So that this exact thing, which part of the U.S. government didn't want to happen, did happen. The passport was given back. Now, when Oswald and his wife came back to the United States, Marina's diary says that they went to Amsterdam and stayed for 3 days in an apartment which was so clean that they didn't even dare to lie on the sheets. And that is a presumption with which the Warren Commission began, that they had stayed for 3 days in Amsterdam in an apartment. Consider the implications of that if you're a loner. It's a pretty smart thing for a loner to be able to come out of the Soviet Union, with a passport valid only for direct travel back to the United States, and to find an apartment in Amsterdam and stay for 3 days. In fact, given the schedule in the Warren Report, that's impossible, because there wasn't time for them to spend 3 days in Amsterdam. However, they were supposed to have taken a ship directly from Rotterdam on June the 4th. In fact, that ship stopped in Ireland. So it is possible, and in fact, I would say likely, that they stopped off somewhere to be, as we say, debriefed by the CIA. As late as 64, 65, professors could go over to the Soviet Union to give a lecture on, I don't know, Sumerian coins to a learned society. They'd only be in the Soviet Union for a week, and they'd come back, and they would be debriefed by the CIA. Here's Lee Harvey Oswald, who'd been at a CIA base, who went in and told the embassy in Moscow that he was going to go and tell the Russians everything he knew. The report asks us to believe that he just came back to the United States and nobody ever wanted to know what had happened to him until a man who was about to retire from the FBI went around and looked him up in Fort Worth. That's very hard to believe, in fact. And again, we suspect that something was being covered up. He was met in New York by a man who's described in the Warren Report as a representative of Traveler's Aid, a social worker by the name of Spas T. Ryken. Spas T. Ryken is sure that the man he met was only 5'6", not 5'9" or 5'11", but 5'6". He's very sure of this, he says, because the man was about my height or a little bit shorter, and Ryken is 5'6". So there may have been somebody else who came into New York. Now, I'll give another reason why I think that Spas T. Ryken measured that man very carefully. He's described as a social worker, and for all I know, he probably was, but he was also something else. He had just resigned as being the Secretary General of something called the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, which is a group of emigres from Eastern Europe, very right-wing, very anti-communist, the kind of people who have recurrently accused the State Department of harboring communists within their midst. They were in 1962, when Oswald came back, they were in the midst of a real feud with Dean Rusk and John F. Kennedy, precisely on the issue of being soft on communism, of giving up on the goal of liberating Eastern Europe. I don't want to make Spas T. Ryken sound like a conspirator, because I suspect all he was really doing was checking up on Lee Harvey Oswald for the FBI, who are very close to these people, and reporting to the FBI. But I tell you all this information because I do think that Spas T. Ryken looked very carefully at the man who was coming back from the Soviet Union. Now, just to follow up a little bit later on, Lee Harvey Oswald went to New Orleans, right? He handed out what was supposed to be pro-Castro literature for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. But he stamped it with an address, which most of you must know, I'm sure, the address of 544 Camp Street, which even the Warren Report had to admit was the address of an anti-Castro group, the Cuban Revolutionary Council. Today we can update the Warren Report because we've all heard of E. Howard Hunt, and those of us who have read E. Howard Hunt's account of what he did for the CIA in connection with the Bay of Pigs know that he himself admits that he was a political action officer who helped set up the Cuban Revolutionary Council for the CIA. And everyone knows that the CRC had an office in Miami. It had two offices, one in Miami and one in New Orleans. Two registered foreign agents, one in Miami, one in New Orleans. The one in New Orleans was called Ronnie Kerr, and he admits that Lee Harvey Oswald went to see him. In fact, Lee Harvey Oswald saw at least four or five of the Cubans in Hunt's CRC in New Orleans. He also spent most of his time, this loner, you know, got to be on TV in New Orleans and on radio more than once, mostly by associating with a man called Carlos Brangier from the DRE, Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, which has since, in Philip Agee's book that's just come out in England, CIA Diary, I think it was always pretty obvious, but here it is officially said that it was another CIA front, and Oswald was working with them. Finally, it's not certain whether or not Oswald associated with the DRE when he was in Dallas. The accusation has been made. What is certain is that Dallas was the center for the kind of anti-Castro activities which Kennedy had cracked down on in 1963, collection of guns for operations against Castro. A group called Alpha 66 was doing this, and a Treasury agent, it's the job of the Treasury to look into gun running and things like this, and so a Treasury agent in 1963, before the assassination, was looking into the activities of anti-Castro Cubans there. Now, one Cuban that he looked into is a man whose name was Manuel Rodriguez Orcarberio. And I will tell you how the first that the Warren Commission heard of this man was in a relatively early report that somebody who looked just like Oswald had been seen in Oklahoma in the company of a whole lot of Cubans. Well, of course, Oswald was supposed to be a loner, so that was a disturbing story. And the FBI checked out the story in Oklahoma, and they found an anti-Castro Cuban doctor who said, oh, that man, he was shown a photograph of Oswald, and he said, yes, there was a Cuban here who looks like that man. In other words, a man who looked like Oswald, but his name was Manolito Rodriguez, and he gives then the address on Huspeth Street of Manuel Rodriguez Orcarberio. Much later, the Warren Commission interviewed a Treasury agent looking into gun running down in Dallas, and heard that first of all, the Treasury agent said that the group in Dallas, the right-wing group most likely to have been associated in any conspiracy to assassinate the president, was a gun-running group called the Minutemen. This man had been investigating these men, and in connection with those investigations, he had run across a Cuban attempting to purchase guns in Dallas, the same man, Manuel Rodriguez Orcarberio. So he's not only a man who looks like Oswald and an anti-Castro Cuban, but he is also engaged in the very kind of activities that Kennedy tried to crack down on. Now, at this point, the Warren Commission got interested. They did get interested in some interesting things. And they asked for and they obtained an entire file on Manuel Rodriguez Orcarberio. That file is still withheld. We still don't have a chance to know what is in that file. And I think Congress should be told that it's their responsibility to find out. However, there was, again, towards the end of the investigation, a huge file came in on anti-Castro activities in general, and we know quite a lot about this man. He was the head of Alpha 66 in Dallas. He was a member of the DRE, which, as you've already heard, was a CIA front. And not only that, but he was meeting with his friends at an address called an address at 3126 Hollandale, which is practically the same as the address of 3128 Harlandale, which Lee Harvey Oswald had been linked to by a Dallas sheriff way back on November 24th or 25th, 1963. So that if the police and the Warren Commission had really done their homework and investigated this address, and unfortunately there's no indication that anyone ever did, they might have run across this very interesting man way back in December. So you can see there's plenty more to the story of Lee Harvey Oswald than the simple loner that you've heard about. And finally, of course, there's the strange episode of what happened in Mexico City. Oswald is supposed to have gone there. A cable comes back from the CIA chief of station in Mexico City. Tad Schultz has since recently written that the acting chief of station for the CIA in Mexico City for 6 weeks in this period was E. Howard Hunt, and we don't know. E. Howard Hunt has denied it, but we do have a version of the CIA message, and that it, well, let me read it. This is the CIA now contacting the State Department Navy in Washington. Subject, Lee Henry Oswald. And I said that correctly. Subject, Lee Henry Oswald. We'll come back to that in a minute. On 1 October 1963, a reliable and sensitive source in Mexico reported that an American male who identified himself as Lee Oswald contacted the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. The American was described, says the CIA, as approximately 35 years old, with an athletic build, about 6 feet tall, with a receding hairline. It is believed that Oswald may be identical to Lee Henry Oswald, born on 18 October 1939 in New Orleans, Louisiana. Those of you who know this whole story know that the CIA later distributed photographs which very much resembled the man described in this picture, presumably were, the 35-year-old, whereas our Oswald was, of course, 23. And we know of these pictures because the FBI showed one of them to Marguerite Oswald on the weekend of the assassination, and she thought, wrongly but not unreasonably, that the man was Jack Ruby. And so the whole thing got out into the press, and one of the things that the Warren Report had to do was to try and explain the mystery of this 35-year-old man. They never did. We still don't know who it was. We do know that there are a lot of skeletons in the government files on Lee Harvey Oswald, or Lee Henry Oswald. Now, who the heck is Lee Henry Oswald anyway? They're describing our man here, the right birth date, the right birthplace and everything. They're calling him Lee Henry Oswald. Now, just recently, in fact, the day after it was announced that Helms would leave the CIA, the CIA finally allowed to be declassified the CIA file on Oswald. And we learn in that file that the whole question of defectors had been a very, in the highest political sense, a sensitive and important issue back in 59, 60, 61 when Oswald was in Russia, that the White House had asked the State Department to prepare a complete list of all the defectors to the Soviet Union. The State Department had gone to the CIA, and the CIA had gone to a perfectly correct and factual memo in their file about Lee Harvey Oswald, and they prepared a summary of that file for the State Department and changed the data. They changed the name of Lee Harvey Oswald to Lee Henry Oswald. They changed the home place of his mother from Fort Worth, which was correct, to Waco, Texas, which was incorrect, and which also made it impossible for anyone to check out the Lee Henry Oswald story. And finally, they said that Lee Henry Oswald had renounced his citizenship when people over in the State Department, there was a big debate going on in this, but the State Department had pretty well decided that he hadn't. And then way back in 1960, the CIA had opened a file on this non-person, Lee Henry Oswald. And I think we should find out why. Because you can see the consequences of that was that if you computerize that data, and that's exactly what the CIA was doing in those days, you can pump in one set of data about Lee Harvey Oswald and another set of data about Lee Henry Oswald, and you can call on whichever set of data you wish, unless, of course, you cross-reference them. Now, the file said very clearly, you must, and the must is the word used on the file opening sheet, list all alternative names. The CIA was faced with a lot of documents that said Lee Harvey Oswald, and some of them, one of them came across from the State Department with Lee Harvey Oswald in big letters, and somebody went ahead and wrote Lee Henry Oswald, and they never bothered to mark the alternative names in the front of the file. So I think that the CIA knew very well that this was an interesting case, that some kind of mysterious game was going on, which I must say I don't begin to understand myself, but I do see a lot of indications that the CIA was party to it, and I think it's terribly important that people force the Church Committee to find out why the CIA was playing these kind of games with their files. Now, I've gone on too long, and I want to open this up for questions, but, you know, we haven't said a word about Jack Ruby, and yet his story is not so unrelated to this. Because Jack Ruby was not just a man who knew a lot of people in Chicago organized crime, but he was a man who, right after the assassination, was identified in news stories having known top syndicate killers in Chicago, and also, said a Chicago lawyer, had contacted this lawyer way back in 1948 about making a contact with the Kefauver Committee, which suggests that he had at least wanted to act as some kind of government informant. All of that should have been investigated and never was. The commission got one and only one FBI memo about this lawyer, whose name was Lewis Kuttner, and the FBI report on it is just about 5 inches, says that Mr. Kuttner had nothing to add to his previous report. End of FBI curiosity in the whole story. End of Warren Commission interest in the whole story. But if we go to Dallas, we could find at least one policeman, and it's interesting that he works in the narcotics squad, who says specifically that he regarded Jack Ruby as an informant in his field, which was narcotics. And I think that may give us a real clue to what was going on. We also find 7 years before Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, we find that the FBI received a report in 1956 about Jack Ruby, because a woman who in turn was regarded as an informant for the Federal Bureau of Narcotics said that she and her husband had gone to Dallas, that her husband had got involved in a big, and I want to stress the word big, international narcotics deal, and that in some way he received the okay to go ahead through Jack Ruby. Now, there's a report that was in the FBI files way back in 1956, and it doesn't stand alone. There are other similar reports, that some of them after the assassination, that Jack Ruby was the connection in Dallas. Jack Ruby was the man who gave you the go-ahead in Dallas, which suggests that he in some way had the fix with the Dallas police. We know at least that he knew personally, and you'll see how well in a moment, a man who received national notoriety for having tried to be the payoff man to the incoming Dallas sheriff way back in 1946, a man called Paul Roland Jones, who clearly was mafia. Coming down from Chicago, mafia wanted to move into Dallas. He tried to bribe the Dallas sheriffs. There was a double cross, and he was put away. But what makes me think that this Miss Breen in 1956, talking about the narcotics deal, may have been right is that the next year, in 1947, the same payoff man, Paul Roland Jones, who knew Ruby, was arrested himself on narcotics charges, and Jack Ruby almost was too. And the reason that he wasn't was because the Federal Bureau of Narcotics chose to believe Ruby's story that he hadn't been at the crucial discussions for the narcotics deal in Chicago, even though Jones said he was. There's a lot of, I don't want to get into the details of it because we want to get to questions, but you see how this all comes together. If Ruby was some kind of informant for the government in the narcotics field, if you know anything about narcotics, that suggests also that he was on the inside of the narcotics traffic. That's what informants are. They're people who know all about the trade, who tell the government about some people who aren't their friends and not about others who are. This brings us back to Cuba, right? Because in all through the 50s, Cuba was the main point of entry for narcotics into the United States. This is one of the reasons why organized crime was so angry when Castro threw organized crime out of Cuba in 1959. On the one hand, there were the casinos, and we know that Ruby went twice to Havana in 1959 to see one of his closest friends who was running a casino there. Ruby said he idolized this man, McWillie. An FBI report from 1959 calls McWillie a gambler and murderer, which gives you some idea of the kind of people that Ruby idolized. And they were, one of the reasons they were angry is because their casinos were being taken away. Another reason they were angry was because the supply of narcotics was being cut off. We know that Ruby went to at least one man who had been convicted for gun running to Cuba. And we get the picture that this is why the CIA and crime came together in 1960 in order, as different people have told us, to conspire to assassinate Castro. And I haven't proven to you that Oswald was associated with this or that Ruby was associated with this. I've tried to suggest a presumptive case that Oswald was a man known to the intelligence agencies and that Ruby was a man known to organized crime, and that if the government would really force an opening up of the files about what the CIA and organized crime were doing together in those early 1960s against Castro, I think we might find more about what they might also have been going on inside the United States. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Peter Dale Scott speaking at the University of California at Berkeley during a 1975 seminar on the JFK assassination. More than five decades have passed since that assassination, yet conspiracy theories still persist. More disturbing, bad behavior by intelligence agencies and elected officials also persist. Until next time, I'm Scoop Sweeney, reporting for the Late Great News.